It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Defiant Requiem memorializes performances of Verdi's Requiem by Jewish prisoners in a Nazi concentration camp not far from Prague in World War II. It's a live performance of Verdi's Requiem, interspersed with film clips, narration, and testimony from some of the prisoners who took part in those performances in the concentration camp. Conductor Murray Sidlin created this concert drama and will conduct a performance Saturday evening at 7:30 in Fisher Auditorium at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Murray Sidlin joins us from Indiana County. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
For those who don't know the story, if you could briefly tell us about how the imprisoned Czech conductor organized other prisoners to sing Verdi's Requiem.
Well, Raphael Schechter was a conductor, very active in Prague. War breaks out. He's Jewish. He very quickly gets deported, along with many other musicians and artists and professional people, to the Terezin concentration camp about 40 miles from Prague. And there, as the camp begins to fill up with people deported from their locales in Poland and the Czechoslovakia and even as far away as Denmark, the artists and the scholars tried to develop a kind of society that they haven't been able to participate in since the invasion of the Nazis in 1939. Mm-hmm. So let's say after war breaks out in Terezin, culture breaks out. The first two commandants would not allow it. They wanted the prisoners to work and work 12 hours a day of slave labor and 8 days in a row with no time off. One other commandant would not permit anything other than that. So it was eat, some sleep, and die. But the third commandant, a man named Rom, who got the idea that since underground there were lectures going on and there were some concerts going on, sub rosa, that why not elevate that and give some sort of respite from the stress and the terror to let people try to forget about their hunger, their illnesses, their no protection from the elements, and so forth.
Right.
So the third commandant allowed for a great deal of cultural activity. Over the time the Terezin existed, there were 2,400 lectures by 530 prisoners and over 1,000 concerts. So this conductor, Raphael Schechter, gets the idea. Look, he wanted to create performances of the Verdi Requiem. Coincidentally, that's this one of the two scores he brought with him from Prague because he loved the Verdi and he couldn't leave home without it. He had no idea where he was going, so he had no idea he was ever going to produce it. But he decided that there were enough concerts now, there was enough activity that maybe, just maybe, he could put together a viable, workable choir. And he did, and there were 16 performances of the Verdi Requiem. Hmm.
Were you compelled, once you learned of this story, to memorialize this courageous stand? And if you would, how did this concert drama come to fruition in your mind and in reality?
Well, I stumbled on the story. I mean, literally stumbled on it. I was living in Minneapolis at the time, was on the faculty of the University of Minnesota, and I was on my way to Portland, Oregon, where I had accepted a position as a resident conductor of the Oregon Symphony. So when I was walking down a street in Minneapolis, came across a bookstore, picked a book out of a on-sale pile, and it was a book called Music at Terezin. And then I opened it up randomly to a chapter entitled Raphael Schechter, 3 pages. Hmm. And it told the story of here's this guy who excels in music in his native Romania and Bucharest, gets a scholarship to go to the Janáček Conservatory in Brno in Czechoslovakia, excels, goes to Prague to apprentice where a lot of famous people apprenticed. In those days, Budapest and Prague were the two most important cities for the up-and-coming people. So he gets a job at a small opera company, starts conducting the Czech opera. Things are going well. War breaks out. That's it. He's interned. And so once I came across the story, and it said at the bottom of that chapter, and he put together a volunteer chorus of 150 people and taught them Verdi's Requiem by rote, and he gave 16 performances between October 43 and June 44, and I said, nonsense. Nonsense. Can't be. First of all, why would he want to? Mm. Why would you want to put together a work so steeped in the Catholic liturgy in a prison camp where everybody's Jewish?
Yes.
What's that all about? Okay, so there was that mystery. And then the idea he got volunteers, and he taught them by rote because he had the only score. So there was nothing right about that chapter. And frankly, I started out to set out to prove it wrong, because I was very worried about erroneous information pertaining to the Holocaust. Right. I mean, the deniers are out there, the revisionists are out there. And if you make one mistake, their next question is, what else is not true? And that's what worried me. So instead of finding out that it didn't happen, I found out that it did happen. I was put onto some internet sites of Holocaust survivors and found some names and went hunting and came across a man who lived outside of Boston, who was the roommate of the conductor. He was the roommate of Raphael Schechter. His name was Edgar Kraza in Newton, Mass. And I went to see him and spent 6 hours, my first visit, with him and his wife, and learned the story of how they were all recruited. And so once I learned this story, yes, I was consumed. I was magnetically drawn in. The gates clanged shut behind me, and there was no way I could escape making sure that this story became known.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with conductor Murray Sidlin. He has created a concert drama, Defiant Requiem, which will be performed this Saturday evening on the campus of Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Murray, there's a documentary about this historical example of spirit of defiance. Let's listen to a very brief clip from it.
It was something which made us strong. It has given us a resistance against our fate.
Doing a performance was not entertainment. It was a fight for life.
This, Verdi's Requiem, put all of us into another world. This was not the world with the Nazis. This was our world.
Resistance against our fate. Not entertainment, a fight for life. Murray, when you hear those voices, those thoughts, do you still have the same emotions, reactions as when you first learned of the story?
Every time I hear it, nothing that they say in that film or in our performance where we use clips of those films, it's never on deaf ears, and I'm never not moved deeply. It's not only their words, it's just looking at their faces, looking into their eyes on the screen, and knowing the tragic vision they have. They were there, they saw it. I'm just a messenger. But they actually experienced the horror. They know things about mankind that you and I don't know, Kevin. They know the depths to which man can go if it's not checked and if we're not vigilant. And here's a situation where they came out of it, and they too came out of it, I believe, because they were guided to be the messengers to tell us, to remind us, and to verify what happened, and to verify what we can do as humans if we're not compassionate and empathetic, and if we're not the kind of people that all religions teach us to be.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Were the performances in the concentration camp a message? You can do your worst to us, but you're not going to break our spirit.
Yes, it's responding to the worst of mankind with the best of mankind. It's absolutely. And I came across a man who went to three performances as a young person in the camp. Three performances he attended. Why? He says, because it was harmonious. And I said, you mean the Verdi Requiem? It's a beautiful piece. No, it was the collaboration. It was all harmonious. We lived in insanity. We lived in chaos. And here on stage is one man whose physical gestures suggested, and the choir responded harmoniously. Mm. He says, that we thought was missing from our lives, and he gave us hope and symbolism of that it can be resurrected.
Right. As a conductor and the conductor of this performance, do I assume that your back is to the audience?
You assume correctly.
All right. Yes. So I imagine, it would just in a couple sentences, if you would, I imagine there are gasps from the audience to what they see and hear, maybe even some tears that you can't see. But do you sense all of that?
Oh, yes. In fact, when we performed this in Jerusalem, there was no question that some of the things that is said, some of the visions that are on the screen, and some of the music evoked whimpers. You could hear it. It was audible. It was quite audible. Whereas when we did it in Berlin, the silence was deafening.
Hmm. And final quick question. It's been 16 years since you, I believe it was 16, since you created this concert drama, 73 years since the closing of the concentration camps. Briefly, why does this remain such a powerful story?
First of all, it remains a powerful story because the music was their nutrition. It shows us what the arts can do. 2,400 lectures were given by 530 prisoners, over 1,000 concerts, under the era of desperation, of the worst possible treatment by man to man. What did these prisoners do? They reached out for the arts and humanities as inspiration and assurance. That is the message.
Murray Sidlin will conduct his concert drama Defiant Requiem, Verdi at Terezin, Saturday evening at 7:30 in Fisher Auditorium at the University of Indiana of Pennsylvania. Murray Sidlin, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, my privilege. Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Chuckles the Dolphin dies at the Pittsburgh Zoo in 2002. He was the only Amazon River dolphin in America at the time, weighing 225 pounds and stretching 8.5 feet. In his obituary, he was described as a Pittsburgh celebrity, but maybe not for the best reasons. He was known for biting trainers and zoo volunteers and at least three visitors. He even pulled a female worker into his tank once. But he was beloved and the last dolphin at the zoo. He was 34 years old when he died. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Weight gain, hot flashes, menopause can be really uncomfortable. Doctors sometimes prescribe hormones to help, but more women are turning to so-called natural remedies, known as bioidentical hormone treatments. A report finds that the bioidentical sector was worth nearly $300 million in 2016, and it's growing. But 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports that some doctors warn bioidenticals may not be worth the money.
More than a dozen people, mostly women in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, are crowded into a storefront in a Murrysville strip mall. They're here for the grand opening of Be Balanced, a Lancaster-based holistic wellness franchise with 20 locations around the country. One of the people I meet here is Amy Miller of Uniontown.
I definitely think hormones have a lot to play in our health.
Be Balanced claims to help women naturally balance their hormones. A breast cancer survivor, Miller says her body hasn't been the same since her illness, so she's been looking into holistic alternatives.
And it's funny, I just did some research online about a month ago, so when I saw this grand opening and she was doing this little talk, that's what got me interested.
The she Miller is referring to is Don Cotello, the company's founder. While holding colorful cardboard graphs, Cotello describes the Bee Balance program as a natural hormone therapy, which promises to help women lose 15 to 20 pounds in a month.
If you can keep your hormones balanced, you'll have a very easy time, just like a younger person. If a younger woman eats a bunch of pizza.
Cotello, whose background is in health and fitness, says a combination of lifestyle and lack of progesterone are to blame for many menopausal symptoms. To help women feel better, Bee Balance offers a sort of hybrid service. It coaches clients to adopt better diet, exercise, and sleep habits. But what sets it apart from something like Weight Watchers are its liver supplements and progesterone creams.
Using this as almost like a multivitamin for your hormones.
These creams are a type of bioidentical, sometimes referred to as natural hormone therapy. They're often derived from plants. Some proponents argue they're safer than something prescribed by a doctor.
They're sort of promoted, I think, sometimes as a fountain of youth.
Dr. Catherine Scruggs is an OBGYN at UPMC, where she focuses on menopausal management.
Like, they're going to make your sex drive like it was when you were 25, that, you know, you'll lose weight.
Scruggs says it makes sense that some women see results with Bee Balance due to its emphasis on stress management, proper sleep, and diet. But she says these bioidenticals are no better than synthetic hormones, and the placebo effect is probably a factor with both.
Whether it's hormones or antidepressants or some of the other things that are used to treat hot flashes, in the placebo group, about 30% will report improvement.
And Bee Balance clients are likely motivated to adhere to diet and exercise recommendations because the program's expensive. The company says the cost averages a little more than $240 a month. Scruggs says she often sees patients pay out of pocket for bioidenticals. But if women need hormone therapy, and some do, she says she can prescribe treatments that insurance will likely cover.
The person who's probably going to give you the best advice is the person who doesn't have an incentive to sell you something. I make the same amount of money whether you walk out of here with a prescription or not.
But Cotello, founder of Bee Balance, says she's just as qualified as most physicians, if not more so, and says she sees promising results all the time.
I'm very hopeful. I know the body can change. So what if we fix this in all these women? This one probably wouldn't have to get breast cancer. This one's thyroid would be balanced out. This one would be able to go off psychotropic drugs. And the reason I say that this one would lose weight is because I see it every day. We're not medical. We're not going to make claims like that, but I am going to tell stories when I see them.
Cotello says the company plans to open another 10 stores around the country in the coming year. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Black History Month with a musical reflection. Stevie Wonder's Happy Birthday. In 1968, shortly after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., a campaign began to recognize the civil rights leader's birthday with a national holiday. The first federal bill to make it to the House of Representatives came in 1979 and failed to pass. A year later, musician Stevie Wonder wrote a song to advocate the recognition of King's birthday. The song Happy Birthday was released as a single in 1980, as well as on Wonder's Hotter Than July album. Its intent was to popularize the idea of a holiday for Dr. King, and Wonder did more than just write a song. He organized marches, spoke at rallies, and even went before Congress. As he told CNN in 1983, the holiday would be more than a celebration of King's life.
It would be a day for us to reflect upon our responsibility as human beings, as recognizing all of those who have lived and died for the principles of peace and unity and equality for all people. So let us all begin. We know that love can win. Let it out, don't hold it in. Sing it loud as you can. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Due to Stevie Wonder's advocacy, a petition for the holiday got 6 million signatures and was signed into law in 1983. The first Martin Luther King Jr. Day was observed on January 20th, 1986. But it took 14 years before the holiday was observed by name in all 50 states. For more audio celebrating Black History Month, listen to WYEP throughout February or go to WYEP.org/Black History Month.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette publisher J.R. Block appointed a new executive editor this week. It was the latest in a series of dramatic developments at the PG, from the ongoing contract dispute to the firing of editorial cartoonist Rob Rogers, and a shift to the right in the paper's editorial page to a blow-up in the newsroom to the elimination of 2 days of printing. We're going to talk about what all these developments could mean for the future of the Post-Gazette with a group of veteran journalists. On the line from Toledo is Nolan Rosenkranz, president of the Newspaper Guild at the Toledo Blade, which is the Post-Gazette's sister newspaper. Snowed in at her home in Pittsburgh, we have Mackenzie Carpenter, who retired from the Post-Gazette in August of 2015, an active voice in the paper's union guild. In studio, Andrew Conti, director of the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University, and Rob Rogers, syndicated editorial cartoonist and former editorial cartoonist for the Post-Gazette. Welcome to y'all. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with the most recent development this week. Publisher J.R. Block named Keith Burris to oversee the paper's reporting. But Burris will still maintain his post as editorial editor for the Post-Gazette, as well as the Toledo Blade. Burris replaced David Shribman, who somewhat unexpectedly retired early in December. Let's start with your thoughts. Let's start with Nolan in Toledo.
Well, for me, it wasn't particularly surprising. John often looks for managers that will be loyal to him and push his vision, and Keith has shown that that's the kind of manager that he is. The Block Communications also has been consolidating some executive positions. Right now in Toledo, the general manager of the newspaper is also our executive editor, so the business and news sides are linked. So these sort of ethical ground crossings by the Blocks when it comes to their newsroom leadership this is not the first time they've done something like this.
All right. Mackenzie, your thoughts.
I will say that there is some precedence at the Post-Gazette for this. John Craig, the late revered John Craig, our executive editor, ran editorial meetings, although the editorial page was very ably edited by Michael McGough, who's now with the LA Times in Washington, D.C. But I think the difference is this. John was an old school journalist. He was a contrarian. He was not an ideologue. And Keith Burris, who I do not know, has shown himself to be, I think, frankly, well outside the mainstream of thought when it comes to issues like racism and sexism. I think he is an ideologue, and that concerns me.
WESA, we should note, has reached out on multiple occasions to both Mr. Burris and Mr. Block for interviews and have been turned down or received no replies. So initial reactions here in studio, Rob, then Andy, to the appointment of Keith Burris. Rob?
Well, I've had my experience with Keith Burris has been pretty well documented.
Right.
So I don't see any problem with it at all. I'm kidding. I think that if his management of the editorial page while I was there is any indication, I don't think this is a good sign. He was not very respectful to me as a 25-year veteran of the paper, an award-winning cartoonist, and I think he treated me not very well. So I can't imagine that he would necessarily treat the other reporters well. So,
Andy.
I met him one time. Seems like a nice guy, very charming, despite what everyone else says. But I think it is unusual to have one person who's in charge of news and opinion. That's just not something that you really often see at newspapers. Although I think as Mackenzie said, we would be able to get over it, except for in the fact that this case, Keith was the one who oversaw what the public has perceived to be as a real shift to the right, a more conservative populist shift at the Post-Gazette. And so to have him now also in charge of news means that the public will have to be vigilant to see, well, does that attitude also now start to bleed into the news side?
Mm-hmm. A bit of a clarification. Mr. Burris had said he'd be glad to join the Confluence as an analyst about news happening in the region, but would not talk about activities and events and changes at the Post-Gazette. So besides the, you know, whether somebody should have a foot in both editorial and in news, is it actually too big of an ask for one person to do all of that? Andy, let's start with you on this one.
I mean, in terms of the actual job, I mean, I don't think it necessarily is. It's just a question of how do you divide your, you know, your sort of your mental thinking. As journalists, we've always thought of ourselves as being objective, as not having an opinion, to the point where you get somebody like the editor, Len Downey, the editor of the Washington Post, who famously never voted because he didn't even want to go into the polling place and pull a lever, you know, because that would signal that in somewhere in his mind he had, you know, he had made a decision, I prefer this person over the other. If you have that person running the editorial and the news side, then you've got, you know, this person's making those sorts of opinionated choices all day and then also going in and trying to be objective on the news side.
Mackenzie, you brought up John Craig a couple minutes ago. Is it too big of a job for one person?
That I can't answer. But John seemed to handle it pretty well. But he had, again, Michael McGough, a brilliant editorial writer who it more than helped him. Let me just say that my concern is also about the news side in terms of so far we've seen them do a wonderful job of staying objective, doing their jobs, putting together terrific journalism. My hat is off to the news side of this newspaper. I am worried, though, about what this will mean, especially going into the next 2 years. With the presidential election coming up, what kind of placements are stories going to have? How are they going to be skewed? You can't just help now, but look at the news side more warily because of this appointment.
How much of a challenge is that, to have reporters needing to be objective but with a strong editorial opinion of the publication they're working for? Nolan, let's start with you on that one.
Well, I mean, we've always struggled with this under John Block's leadership because he has, you know, especially in Toledo, tried to or successfully either directly inserted himself in the news coverage or in the opinion section, put leadership in place that will anticipate or amplify his views on things. So, you know, I've already been concerned in Toledo about the effect of headlines for political coverage, or even John calling in and insisting that something being changed in a political story so that it better meets his views. But then also having to deal with, as reporters, opinions by Keith or John outside of the mainstream, it does make it more difficult to do our job. And frankly, unfortunately, it makes it more difficult for the other editorial writers who are doing good work and work hard to be ethical journalists. And then they'll have something dropped by Keith or John onto their page and everybody gets associated with it. It makes our jobs more difficult. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Andy, you spent many years reporting for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, formerly owned by an outspoken Republican, Richard Mellon Scaife. But of course, you'd go out in the community, you'd talk to people of all stripes, political leanings. For you as a reporter, how does the opinion section of a paper affect a journalist's ability to do their job?
Yeah, so Dick Scaife was famously conservative. You know, when he died, he left a ton of money to the Heritage Foundation. But when he was alive, he never came into the newsroom, never said, came to my desk. I was an investigative reporter there right for many years. He never came in and said, you can't do that story, or you have to do this story, you have to go after this person. Ironically, it was when I was at a newspaper in Cincinnati, a corporate-owned newspaper, and the publisher there walked in and said, I just had lunch with the director of the Visit Cincinnati, the equivalent there, said, I don't like that person. Can you see what you can find about him? I'm like, Really? Mm-hmm. It happens. It fortunately, even though there was this reputation at the Trib that it was a conservative newspaper, it didn't bleed in. I will say that it was difficult, though, to oftentimes I would wake up and look at the Trib and I'd see some headline and think, oh, here's the conservative bias coming through. But then I would look at the Post-Gazette and be like, oh, they also had the same headline or they had something very similar, you know. And so it's hard to see that subjective bleed. It would take months of research and analysis to say, well, now the paper's gone more conservative, unless there's something super obvious, I think. Mm-hmm. Rob?
My experience on the editorial page when I was working for John Craig was that I could draw something that he didn't agree with. And even over the Afghanistan war, we had a confrontation a little bit where he said, this isn't what the paper believes. And I said, yeah, I know. and he said, okay, just as long as we're clear. So I think that also should be the way it should be on the news side. There should be a separation, even if it's not, even if it's not a separate editor, there should be a separation of, free thought and opinion, and also just news, unbiased news coverage.
Okay. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm joined by a panel of journalists and storytellers, many with current and former ties to the Post-Gazette, to talk about recent changes in leadership and editorial direction. So much of the public angst started last year, Martin Luther King Day, with Keith Burris's Reason as Racism editorial. That seemed to signify a change in direction, much of a tilt to the right. So an unpopular question, maybe, doesn't an owner have the right to determine the editorial direction of their paper? Mackenzie, should we start with you?
Sure. I mean, he's the guy who signs our paychecks. It's just that in the context of this particular newspaper and its legacy, this was particularly egregious, I think most people felt. And in fact, John Block's own family wrote a letter to the editor, which he did publish, complaining and expressing their dismay with the editorial. So the answer to your question is, sure, he has the right to publish anything he wants. It's just that it's going to be at the expense of the newspaper's brand, its reputation, its legacy. And believe me, nobody cares more or says he cares more about the paper's legacy than John Block.
All right. Nolan, your take on that, about an owner's right to have the editorial slant that he/she wishes to do.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between having the right to do something and whether something is right to do. He owns the paper and he gets to make those decisions, but we also, as employees, get to speak out when we disagree with them. One of the elements of the shift in tone or messaging from the opinion section that we as a union have really objected to is not just some of the opinions we consider to be offensive, but what appears to be an antagonism towards journalism from Keith and John on the opinion pages on the things that they write. Keith has frequently written things that bleed almost into the fake news aspect of things, and at a time when our craft is under such attack, it would be nice to have the leadership of our newsroom editors support us. And it feels like at times that Keith and John are literally attacking us from the opinion section. So can he do it? Yeah, but we also don't have to just sit by and watch it happen.
Andy?
Yeah, absolutely. The publisher has the right to put in the paper what they want to put in the paper. And, when that Reason is Racism column ran, some of my students at Point Park were saying, well, why would the employees do this? I said, well, let's think this through the whole way. So if you're an employee there, you work for the publisher, and the publisher comes and says, run this column, you have a couple of choices, right? You can either run the column, or you can polish your resume and go look for another job, right? And that's the same choice that readers have, too. Readers don't have to read the Post-Gazette. Nobody's forcing them to read it. If you don't like it, go find another news outlet, right?
Rob, yep. you mentioned just a moment ago about John Craig would say something, that's not the paper's position, right? But just so you understood.
Right, and there was a time when they killed six in a row of my cartoons and people were outraged. people were calling it censorship, but it really wasn't, because you're right. He owns the paper, and he's allowed to have whatever content he wants. And so I would tell them, well, no, it's not censorship, but it is you know, trying to blot out a certain voice, and especially when a voice has had a history at the paper and a following and everything else. But no, it is his choice. And
I just wanted to point out on that, because you're talking about the cartoons that never ran in the Post-Gazette, we're actually having a gallery show of them at Point Park. And some people have asked, well, why would you do that? Why would you put up these cartoons that never ran in the Post-Gazette? We think it's important to, one, show them to the public so that people can see what didn't run, but also to have that discussion around what it means to have satire and to hold power accountable and to raise these questions that journalism always has done.
A reminder to our listeners, the editorial page, of course, is opinionated by design, opinions by the newspaper's leadership and its readers. The news side is supposed to be objective. So let's move on. Keith Burris, the Post-Gazette's new top editor, has been highly critical of the collective media coverage of President Trump. J.R. Block has been a Trump supporter as reporters. Does that weigh on you at all, the criticism of your industry? Mackenzie.
Does it weigh on me, the criticism of my industry?
Yes.
Well, first of all, let me note that I took a buyout 3.5 years ago, so I am a recovering journalist. But as far as their criticism of the news media, again, I think I just go back to they have the right to speak out on whatever they want. It's just a shame. That's all. I mean, I'm thinking back to do you remember when a whole bunch of national newspapers, I believe, ran an editorial on their front pages protesting? God, it's been so long, and there have been so many crises. Some Trump policy, was it the immigration? Help me out with this, people. The bottom line is the Post-Gazette didn't do it. And there was an editorial, I think, I don't know if Keith Burris wrote it or who wrote it, but it was critical of the newspapers that did. And I just thought, my God, this goes against everything we have been taught about the role of the journalist, which is, again, to stand up for certain values in our society, to, you know,
right.
So I'm just saying, it's disturbing.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left. But this is more than opinion. Mr. Block came to the newspaper's office, created a disturbance last Saturday. Witnesses said he appeared drunk and yelled at employees and his young daughter, upset with a large union sign that said shame on the Blocks. So is this just another event, an escalation of the problems in the Post-Gazette? Andy?
As an outside observer, I mean, one of the things we heard that the publisher said when he came into the newsroom last week was that the previous editors hadn't been loyal enough to the family, that they were disloyal, they weren't loved by the family. So it makes one wonder now, well, what has the Keith Burris done to prove his loyalty? What's he going to have to do to prove his loyalty?
All right. Very briefly, Nolan, I want to get to you. The relations between the employees and management are still quite tense because of a lack of contract. Nolan, Toledo Blade employees have had their own contract issues with the Block family briefly, have they not?
Yeah, I mean, we have. We're in the same exact fight that the Post-Gazette guild members are in. We haven't had a raise in 16 years. I believe it's been 13 years in Pittsburgh. They've slashed at pay and benefits. And it's really just been a discouraging time under John and Alan Block, his twin brother's leadership at the papers. We don't feel supported. We feel constantly under attack by our own leadership. And that's why sort of the Burris stuff and John's actions just are so indicative of a longer process of treatment of staff that, you know, they don't care that people are outraged. They don't care that people are upset or fearful in the workplace or don't feel valued. That's what we feel. And I should note, John Block showed up in the Blade newsroom last night, and none of these things that occurred in Pittsburgh were addressed at all. You don't hear any apology or I shouldn't act like that. He just walks around like nothing happened.
All right. I just want to get one more thought in very briefly, 20 seconds. Who wants this? What would you say to the staff of the Post-Gazette right now? What support would you offer? 20 seconds. Rob, well, why don't you take it?
Yeah, there are so many great journalists still working at the paper, and I do feel for them, and I hope that you know Keith does treat them with respect and lets them do their job. Hang in there.
Rob Rogers is a syndicated editorial cartoonist. Mackenzie Carpenter, former employee of the Post-Gazette, longtime journalist. Nolan Rosencrantz is the president of the Newspaper Guild at the Toledo Blade. And Andrew Conti is the director of the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, bishops from around the world are gathering in Rome to meet with the Pope for the next 4 days to discuss the fallout from the clergy sex abuse scandals, including here in Pennsylvania. What actions could be taken? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stinelli, Joya Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.